This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
We're moving away from this idea of a site of care. The patient is the site of care. So if you start there and you look at your episodes of care and you say, okay, well, whatever can be delivered virtually should be delivered virtually.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Durin, and today, Chris Pagano and Tony Guth are joining me to talk about virtual health as well as digital public health monitoring. We're going to split into two discussions. They're linked together, but they're pretty distinct. Chris and I are going to start digging into virtual health, and then we're going to bring in Tony to talk about digital public health and monitoring through contact tracing and antibody testing, a topic that's showing its head in the news and is going to be a big national focus for the next couple months. So we're excited to talk about the role health systems should play within that discussion. So Chris, we could easily make this podcast and probably many more about some of the exciting things that have happened in virtual health and that you expect are going to continue happening. You've written a lot about it as well. So we're going to link to all the other things that you've done on this topic in the show notes. But we also wanted to take this opportunity to go through a few of these things. So we'll keep this at a pretty high level, but just know there's a lot more details in writing. And we appreciate we may not be doing some of these topics justice, but that's what we're going to do in this format. So, all right, give me a quick current state assessment.
You know, I would say on a high level, we've moved about 5 years into the future when it comes to virtual health over the last 3 to 4 months. So while this initially began largely due to the massive demand for care that we've seen without obviously having that corresponding risk of exposure to COVID-19, that was very quickly followed up by legislative changes, much of which, as you noted, you know, we've provided some in-depth analysis around on the site, but that really solidified organizations' ability to do this in a viable fashion. And what we've seen over time, that patients love it. 80% of those who try it say that they either like it or love it. 61%, 62% or so of individuals who haven't even tried it, they say that they really like it or love it as well. And so we're in the neighborhood here where 68% of all Americans say that they either like or love virtual health. We knew a lot of this ahead of time, right? We knew that patients who tried it liked it, but to see that really be confirmed with these much higher level numbers has been fantastic. And what's been interesting actually to watch is how the attitudes of physicians have started to shift as well. So, you know, look, historically, physician buy-in has been quite challenging. But over time here, as physicians are gaining more experience with using virtual health, they're coming to find that they really like it as well. And I think part of that is that they're getting used to it. I think the other part of it is, frankly, I think the systems are starting to get better, which is something that, you know, obviously we've worked with our clients around for many years. And what's interesting is I'm starting to hear conversations around maybe there's ways to have this benefit clinicians as well. And I think that's going to be critically important as we're looking ahead to the future. We're seeing some very concerning numbers around a third of physicians citing very high levels of stress, anxiety, depression, or are planning on possibly either closing their practices, changing career paths, or retiring early. You know, when we think about the type of pressure that that's going to put on organizations, if we see that type of clinical bandwidth contraction, certainly innovative approaches are going to be necessary. And I think virtual health is at the center of that. So there's a lot of movement going on in the virtual health space. But again, I think it is safe to say that we have really entered into a new paradigm of care delivery.
So because we're SG2 and the core of what we do and what gets a lot of us excited is forecasting future healthcare utilization. So how are these rapid changes going to impact the setting, the payment, and patterns of care in the future?
We're anticipating that we're going to continue to see this very significant shift towards virtual continue moving forward. So we're going to put out some much more targeted and sophisticated projections here in a week or so. I think at least what I can say in this forum is that we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of about 43% or so of all E&M visits we anticipate will shift to the virtual health site of care by 2030. So that's a very, very significant shift moving forward. And it's definitely something that's going to have a remarkable impact on the overall landscape. If I'm thinking about payment, I think that's a little bit more tricky. We have different levels of payment parity right now on the CMS level. Of course, you know, we have full payment parity, Medicaid, and the commercial space is a little bit more variable. We're anticipating that we'll largely see that to continue to be in place moving forward. But I will note that there are a number of ways that this could shake out. So it's possible that there could be some limited guardrails guardrails put around some of this, really focused likely on those chronic care patient populations, ensuring that there is appropriate reimbursement for that. But you know, on the lower acuity side, I think that there's a little bit more wiggle room where we might see some of that get rolled back. We'll see. I could also see a world here where, especially given some of the conversations we're having with our colleagues in Washington, that there is a pretty decent chance that we're going to see an accelerated shift towards different types of alternative payment models. So, you know, think value-based care here, moving into the beginning of next year. And needless to say, boy, in that type of a payment world, virtual health is extraordinarily valuable. So I think the one thing we can say definitively around payment at this point in time is that we've run all the different scenarios, and we just don't see a path forward where virtual health isn't a core asset towards care delivery.
That's pretty clear. I like it. So I also understand that you build a methodology for health systems to kind of look across their business, look across their system of care, and quantify the shift at the disease and service line level. So how should strategy leaders think about the shift to virtual as they plan for reimagination and beyond?
We've developed what we think is a pretty good approach to understanding the needs of different organizations. It's market dependent, it's organizational strategy dependent. There's a lot of moving parts around this, but I think at least from a consistency perspective, the areas that is going to need to be focusing in on obviously would start with elective surgeries, right? That's where everybody's thinking about, and that is definitely a priority. But I think it's important to note that virtual plays a role there, right? You can do a lot of that preoperative work, a lot of that post-operative work virtually. And so that can improve your margin management. And I think the other thing to think about here is that consumer confidence is going to lag behind these actual openings. We recognize all 50 states at this point are at some point along their reopening plan. That doesn't mean that everybody is going to immediately come forward and be comfortable, especially going into healthcare facilities. And I'm thinking about who are going to be some of the prime individuals where they're going to be a little bit more uneasy. It's those chronic care patient populations. In particular, those who are immunocompromised, you need to recognize that those are not all older individuals. That's a pretty large population of people who are going to need that ongoing care. And you need to be able to find a way to actually deliver it in a way that feels safe and is safe. And I would offer that virtual certainly can be a critical answer for that. Maybe the last point I would mention here will be in the long run, if I'm thinking a little bit further on the time horizon moving forward, I think the most significant thing to realize is that we're moving away from this idea of a site of care. The patient is the site of care. So if you start there and you look at your episodes of care and you say, okay, well, whatever can be delivered virtually should be delivered virtually. And then, you know, we can look at what's left and at least, you know, understand what really requires in-person care during this crisis period, what maybe does need to be deferred. But if you think about it through that lens, you get to some really interesting questions. So I would urge organizations to be thinking about what does your facility design look like, right? Do you really need that full current physical footprint that you're supporting right now? I think these are the types of questions that really leaders need to be asking themselves.
I could ask you about 100 follow-up questions, but thanks for going through that in about as quick as you possibly could, I think. We're going to shift gears now to our conversation about digital public health and monitoring, about contact tracing and antibody testing. And there's really a link to virtual health. I understand virtual health programs play a big role in running those programs for health systems. It's often an associated virtual health visit at the beginning to review patient suitability for further testing. So our focus throughout this discussion will be on the role health systems should play from a business, data management, ethical, and community wellness perspective. Tony's going to join us for this portion of the conversation. He and Chris have been leading our work in this area. Tony, give us the landscape. Provide some clarity, because these two things, antibody testing and contact tracing, can sometimes get lumped together and talked about in tandem.
You're right. Contact tracing and antibody testing are frequently being discussed together, but they both play vital roles in a larger effort to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 and to give the general public the confidence to go back out in the world. And that's a word we hear a lot in the context of these conversations, is confidence. And what's in the scope of possibilities is, and perhaps only if we're optimistic and all the disparate pieces work together, and we'll talk about how hard that can be. What's possible is that we could get in front of subsequent waves of COVID-19 infections, which appear to be becoming progressively more inevitable as time passes. And so we can't go back in time and flatten this initial kind of surge that we've had, like South Korea, but further suffering can be prevented and surge resource planning can be done with more confidence if testing and contact tracing picks up to the point where we can mitigate future waves. So let me give a quick primer on these two things and break each one down, and then we can move forward from there. So
yeah, thanks.
Antibody testing, it allows us to see whether an individual has had COVID-19. If you had the virus, your body creates these antibodies to prevent the virus from making copies and stops the spread of the infection. The test takes a sample of blood and identifies the presence of those antibodies. So there are a number of different antibody tests out there, right? Quest Diagnostics is offering one for $120 that doesn't need a doctor's order. So that's purely consumer initiated and begins online, which is interesting. LabCorp offers antibody testing at its own locations and at some Walgreens stores, but that requires a doctor's order. There are a lot out there. And of course, many hospitals and health systems are offering these tests. What's exciting is that antibody testing is evolving pretty quickly. There are rapid finger prick tests out there that don't require a full blood draw and take 10 to 15 minutes to get results. And I know that we talked to a large health system recently that told us they used this finger prick test on their own surgical staff and found that 2% had antibodies. So the rapid tests are easily distributed and can be done at home. The results can be uploaded to a virtual care provider, like you said, Trevor. That's kind of the link here, right, between antibody testing and virtual health. It's often housed in the virtual care platform for these providers, and the provider can easily interpret those results and keep them in an EHR like Epic, for example. Is that we're not 100% sure if these antibody tests are perfectly accurate. I believe only four or so have been formally approved thus far, and usually under emergency pretenses, right? And additionally, there's no certainty that there's even such a thing as, you know, quote unquote immunity to COVID-19. The research isn't there yet. There's some promising stuff. I think this week we just had some results, I think, out of Beth Israel Deaconess that said, you know, some monkeys are showing some antibodies that prevent them from getting COVID-19 again, but we don't know how long those antibodies last. So that's something to worry about. Antibody testing, like we said, is different than contact tracing. So switching to contact tracing, the purpose of that is to really contain the spread of the virus. Contact tracing is a process where some authority, almost always a public health authority, helps a patient who's tested positive identify everyone they've been in contact with since they became infectious. It sounds like a simple and straightforward process, but it's a demanding effort from a manpower and technology perspective. The process of contact tracing, a simplified version of it anyway, goes like this, right? You download a contact tracing app, which relies on your device's Bluetooth tech. Your phone constantly sends out this Bluetooth random ID number that can be recognized by phones of people around you. And it's a two-way street, right? Your phone is capturing other people's phones' codes. And your app lets you know that someone you were physically close to, for example, tested positive for COVID-19 X number of days ago. It knows the person you were near tested positive only if that individual, A, got a test. Of course, we know that's easier said than done sometimes. And two, they inputted their positive status in the app. And then, of course, there's some form of continual contact with the contact tracer in the public health department. You're given a thorough education about what your risk is, and you're told to maintain social distance and stay away or stay home really for 14 days. If you get sick and start showing symptoms, that's when you tell the public health folks and get evaluated by a provider. I mean, this process works. We do it for tuberculosis, right? The CDC has guidelines for investigation of contacts of TB patients. And obviously, this is without the app and the technology, of course, but we're talking a completely different manpower requirement too, given the pervasiveness of COVID-19. It's understanding who's tested positive and really just doing detective work, making sure you have enough contact tracers who have the specialized training and who are reaching out to these folks to actually do the detective work and figure out who they got in contact with and then moving forward from there.
So Tony, are we at a baseline in your mind in any areas of the country where you actually think that we could do this in a way where it would be effective?
That's a tough question. First of all, It's worth trying in areas like New York City. They're trying to hire an army of tracers to figure out who gets sick as they kind of reopen up their economy, which is going to be really important. And they just don't want this to happen again, what happened over the past couple of months. Their curve's going down and their infections, their deaths rather, are going down. And this is the time to get it in place. In the real world, not everybody has a smartphone. In the United States, 81% of the folks have smartphones, and that number is lower for the elderly who are, you know, most at risk for COVID-19. Everyone would have to download and opt in to use the contact tracing app, right? And it's unlikely, but on a scale like COVID-19, we need some kind of tech involved. And people need to download and opt in to use this thing. The benchmark's out there that epidemiologists say we need 60% of the population to use the app and participate for this to work. And there was a recent survey, I forget who did it. I think I read it in The Economist, but it says less than half Americans would actually want to use a contact tracing app. That's not a good sign.
Yeah, thanks for touching on some of those real world dynamics that get in the way of making this work. But I think there's more. Some of it is underlining, some of it's distinctly American. Give me the full gamut of all the reasons this is hard to make work.
A Harvard group thinks we need to hit about 900,000 tests per day in this country. And, you know, that's not a consensus, but it gives you an idea of the ideal scale here. And right now we're doing less than half of that as a country. So, you know, if we don't know who's positive, then we can't even begin contact tracing in a meaningful way. Something else worth mentioning here is that in the real world, every state needs to have the funds to hire contact tracers and build the technology infrastructure needed to actually do the tracing and have all the parties communicating with each other. We all know the states are challenged financially, manpower-wise. To give you an idea, Governor Cuomo in New York wants to hire 17,000 contact tracers, and that's at least 30 tracers for every 100,000 people. So extrapolate that to the whole country, that's huge. That takes money. From a tech infrastructure perspective, it can be unwieldy and an expensive burden, too, because it can get so involved. I know what Illinois is doing. It seems the right way of going about it. Governor Pritzker recently laid out a game plan for contact tracing and includes three tech infrastructure components. First is a disease reporting software. The second is a common management platform. And this is a unified way for all the public health officials in the state to investigate and trace contacts. And third, of course, is the app to be used by COVID patients and contacts. They can use the app to contact or connect with, you know, health department staff and perhaps even medical providers.
But I think if we get to the root issue around a lot of this, frankly, it's around privacy, right? We've already seen concerns and objections raised from civil liberty experts like the ACLU, scientists, security experts. I mean, the concerns around patient privacy, you know, the possibility of potentially this data being shared with different government officials that are inappropriate, and really just the overall idea of conceding certain levels of privacy is something that we're seeing a huge amount of pushback around. And I think one of the big concerns I'm hearing from a lot of individuals out there is if we're creating a database that is based on a proximity record, there's a risk there that we're overestimating the number of exposure events, and we're possibly creating an environment where people's ability to return to their office, participate in large gatherings, I mean, even something like obtaining life insurance. I mean, there's a lot of downstream impacts around this that if we don't get it right, could have some really serious negative implications. But we really got to make sure that we're dotting our I's here, crossing our T's, getting this thing right, because it could really have some very, very troubling implications.
You're exactly right. It's going to be hard not to make these missteps. Every state for contact tracing, every state's going to have its own kind of approach with an app. So you're exactly right there, Chris. And you kind of alluded to missteps with antibody testing, right? It needs to be accurate and effective.
You started off your answers making this seem very clean and possible and hopeful, but the real world's messy. What role can health systems play? I'm sure there's a few different roles. What are the pros and cons of those different roles, and what are we recommending?
From a testing standpoint, it's pretty clear. Play as big a role as you can in providing tests, including antibody tests. That role is probably going to diminish a bit as tests can be done at home and as giant companies like Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp distribute their tests and use their own sites. But health systems are there to interpret results, guide the patient through the system of care, and monitor progress. Monitoring is huge, right? That's probably the best thing a health system can do in this environment is monitoring COVID patients and monitoring the contacts that have been identified in the contact tracing effort remotely, of course, right? Health systems don't and shouldn't own contact tracing. That's for public health authorities. But they can help by partnering with the authorities and making sure these patients and contacts have the education, resources, and regular virtual checkups they need to get by. The health system is a trusted partner with the public health authorities and with the community in a test managing and monitoring situation.
Maybe the other thing I would add, though, as a thought would be, as you're forming these partnerships and having ongoing communication and collaboration with public health officials, if they are identifying patients who have some elevated risk of possible exposure, I think that creating a pathway there where it would allow patients to have an accelerated touch point towards your organization to be able to get the high level of care that they're possibly going to need would be an approach that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, good answers from both of you. Thanks. I think that's clear direction and guidance in a very uncertain future scenario. So thanks for that. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in today. Please subscribe or follow if you want to hear more. I also want to recommend another Vizient podcast, The Modern Practice. It's on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. and it's led by our physician colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva. It provides a clinical perspective into current issues affecting healthcare today. Thanks for tuning into SG2 Perspectives. Look forward to you joining again soon. This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today, we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.